Across the Movie Aisle, presented by the Rebeller Podcast Network. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, editor-in-chief of Rebeller. I am joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you guys today?
Good. How you doing?
Doing great.
Before we get started on this week's show, I just want to tell you guys a bit about RebellerMedia.com. RebellerMedia.com is a one-stop shop for all your film writing needs. Every day, I and my crack team of editors will be gathering the most interesting movie news and essays on the web for you to browse through. Think of us a bit like the Drudge Report for Hollywood. And after you're done checking out the day's headlines, we hope you will stick around and enjoy some Rebeller original. We are going to have S. Craig Zoller talking about some of his favorite graphic novels. We've got an essay from Once Upon a Time in Hollywood editor Fred Raskin on Sally Menke, the steady editing hand behind Quentin Tarantino's rise to prominence. And the great Matt Labash will weigh in on Marvel versus Marty. We have a piece from Rebeller's own Dave Spielman that's going to be about the death of the bro comedy. I'm very excited for people to read that. We are paying good people good money for the content you're enjoying, including the content you're enjoying right now. And we hope you will sign up for a membership, which will get you unlimited access to the site, either $2 a month or $20 a year for the whole year. So that's a pretty good deal. And you just sign up, you send us the money, you get all the access. All right. Now on to the show. First up is controversies and nontroversies. One of the ever-present struggles when it comes to reporting on home entertainment these days is quantifying exactly what people are watching. Some outlets have been more straightforward with this than others. HBO, for instance, breaks down who watches live and who watches later across all platforms. A show like Watchmen may only play to 780,000 people or so live, but weeks later, across all platforms, it will have racked up 9.6 million total viewers. Big difference. But Netflix has always been a bit of a black box, breathlessly announcing record viewership numbers on various products and movies, while rarely saying what the actual numbers are, exactly how many people watched or how much of it they've watched. And on top of that, they don't release box office data for those rare films that do get a theatrical release. Nielsen has tried to pry that black box open a little bit, and the numbers are kind of weird. For instance, the ratings service announced that 13.2 million people watched The Irishman, but only 18% of viewers made it through the movie in one sitting. Only 11% of viewers finished the Breaking Bad movie El Camino. So here's my question, Peter. This is a media question as much as anything else. Yeah. Do journalists need to stop breathlessly reporting on Netflix numbers as if they mean a single thing at all?
Well, I think to the extent that Netflix provides only selective numbers rather than complete numbers for their whole catalog, you have to at least distrust what they're saying a little bit, because when they're only releasing some things some of the time without the context of all of their all the rest of their streaming data, then you don't really have a sense of what it means and how they're making decisions based on that information. And that, to me, is the big thing that's important, especially for journalists to understand, which is, how does Netflix use this information to make decisions about which movies to make and which movies to give more play? I think the Netflix's decision to not release numbers is in some ways understandable, given that they are in a different business than the rest of the Hollywood studios. But it is generally bad for artists, for the people who are making the movies, who don't get to find out what it is, how it is that their movies are doing, and how it is that their movies are doing relative to other films, which is important, right? It's not just that you want your own numbers, you want everybody else's. I think it's very bad for critics and journalists and analysts trying to look at the business and understand it, because it's just a black box. Even when we have some numbers, they don't really tell us anything because we don't have a comp. But there is one way in which I'll defend it a little bit, and I think it's a little bit good for viewers, or at least not bad for viewers, in the sense that box office numbers and popularity, it's a popularity contest. And so there's a lot of kind of queuing of viewers to see the thing that everybody else is seeing. And what Netflix's black box does do is allow viewers to, at least in some sense, to pick for themselves and not feel like, oh, I'm watching this because everybody else is watching this. Yes, there are, Netflix is sending you sort of, oh, pick, watch this. You know, they're deciding in some ways what they want to show you. And there's still media cues and that sort of thing. But there is a little bit of a way in which what Netflix is doing is reducing the popularity effect that comes with box office reporting with mega hits.
Well, but Alyssa, don't you think that actually strikes me as a big negative, frankly? I think I see it as deleterious to the general culture of art and discussion of art and the way that, you know, we all kind of lament for this lost water cooler period, right? But I do think that there is
something to that.
Well, many of us do. Many of us traditionalists.
But there are a couple of things going on here. The first is how you decide what to measure and what measurements are meaningful, right? I mean, the Nielsen ratings for television are meant for advertisers. They're meant to tell you how many eyeballs you're going to get if you advertise a Dodge Durango in front of this show in this hour. And that's not something that applies to Netflix, which does not have advertising. And so what are we measuring and why are we measuring, right? If you are a creative, you want to have some sort of concrete measurement of how many people watched your thing all the way through. And not just that, but how many people subscribed to Netflix and then immediately went and watched your thing, which indicates that people subscribed specifically to watch your thing.
My understanding, though, I'm sorry to interrupt. My understanding, though, is that the creatives do get much more access.
Sure.
That they do get to, they see, like,
but
how many people
public,
are.
But you want some public information mm-hmm. in part because it helps with leverage.
It's not completely clear how much access they get, right. Whether they get contextual information or whether they only get data about right. their
and,
own product.
And part of the problem with what Netflix has done so far is that it hasn't just released limited data. The data it has released has been fundamentally gobbledygook, telling us that people watch, you know, 39 million minutes worth of a particular show right. or movie.
Or 12 million people watched at least 70% of this thing.
Right.
Or that
I mean,
thing.
That's just not meaningful information, and not just because it's not comparative.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, telling you that X number of people watch 70% of something, it's just not a meaningful statistic in any way that we
yeah.
can parse. And so until we see what metric Netflix has decided to use and whether it's something that they've sort of made up out of thin air and what they appear to be using that measurement for, it's hard to tell if this is a meaningful development at all, whether for consumers or for creative types. I do agree that I think not sort of pushing everybody in a particular direction has probably allowed certain smaller, weirder things to thrive on Netflix. I don't know that something like Glow or Orange is the New Black ever would have developed the kind of following that it got without, you know, just sort of being able to kick around on Netflix. I mean, Orange is the New Black was definitely promoted as
that was pretty heavily. I feel like both of those shows were pretty heavily
right,
pushed
but they,
by
but
the,
they weren't
by the
necessarily
network.
You couldn't necessarily promote them as demonstrable hits,
mm-hmm.
right? And so it's absolutely true that certain things have been able to sort of find their following on Netflix in a way that they might have been under greater pressure to do on network television. At the same time, we are in an era of network television where a show like Brooklyn Nine-Nine that barely pulls a million viewers is headed into its eighth season. And so the idea that there is sort of either a major sorting of people into a monoculture or that the threshold to survive in other media is particularly high, I think is just not really true anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the absence of a larger industry-wide conversation about what metrics matter and what they mean, it's hard to say that Netflix, which has a sort of dodgy reputation, is out of step with everyone else.
You know what I'm excited about, or at least curious about, is the coming of the streaming wars and how competition from other mega streamers, Disney in particular, but also, you know, we've got HBO and Amazon continues to kind of be one of the big players here. But we've got all these other streaming companies coming online. And it will be very interesting, I think, to see what sorts of data, if any, they release and what sorts of pressure that puts on Netflix to release its own data. And this is one of the things about box office reporting for traditional films is that studios, you can basically trust the numbers that get put out because there's a whole ecosystem of both partner organizations and competitor organizations that are constantly trying to check them. right? So there's all of the other studios, and then there's the exhibitors themselves, and then all, right? And so because of this kind of network of large corporations, all of whom have an interest in making sure that their competitors and partners are not lying in public about what kinds of money they're making, we get pretty good numbers on box office.
Well, and also they're
and it actually is pretty valuable.
Well, and also the exhibitors collect the ticket money, right? I mean, there is just the revenue flows in a different direction. I think the other thing that's going to be really interesting is what the data say about streaming models, right? Mm-hmm. Because one of the most notable things that Disney has done with The Mandalorian, its first Disney Plus television show, is rather than releasing the whole thing at once, it's dropped a couple of episodes a week. It's sort of an in-between.
It's an episode a week, I think, right? It's just doing a straight episode
I believe
a week,
they started with they three, and then after that it's one a week.
Okay. So, but they, you know, have experimented a little bit with the pacing there. And I think that was smart because it allowed some time to build between the first episode and the second. It still got the second episode to people fairly quickly. And people have talked so much about Netflix's binge model, but I actually think it's been a huge inhibitor for television in terms of people having time to develop an audience, people having time to catch up on the episodes, and people also having a predictable sense of when an episode is going to be discussable. Mm-hmm. And so I will be very curious if data emerge that suggests that that is a stronger model than the sort of binge obsession.
My understanding is that several of the other streamers are actually considering doing weekly releases, not necessarily for every one of their series, but for some of them, and that Netflix has actually raised the possibility of, with some specific series, doing weekly type releases, or a Disney Plus kind of hybrid model where you drop half the season and then let the rest of it spool out.
I also think, frankly, that is a really smart bid to appeal to critics. Because it is exhausting for critics to have to be given an entire season of television, be under pressure to have watched and have recaps ready for it immediately, and to sort of make that investment, not know when they can talk about various plot elements, et cetera. And I think given the amount of pressure critics are under and the sheer number of television that's being produced, going to a weekly model could actually be a really smart way to peel just critical attention away from Netflix shows.
One other, there's a secondary thing here that I'm kind of curious about, and that is this: if you have a movie like The Irishman that is going to be seen by most of the people who see it at home, and fewer than 1 in 5 people are watching it all at a go, and I think we can assume a fair number of the people who stop don't pick back up. Who knows what the actual numbers look like. Is this something that members of the Academy can look at and say, we cannot possibly give Best Picture, first off, to a company that's trying to destroy all of us, second off, to a film that nobody is actually going to end up seeing all the way through, and third, again, is trying to destroy us. I mean, like, this is like what we forget about the Oscars is that it is really a trade industry show that the studios put on to like celebrate their big things. And so, like, sometimes indies break through and it's, you know, oh, look at this great cute little indie movie, but the big studios win the majority of the awards. And I do think that there will be some people who look at what these numbers on The Irishman and say, look, you know, we put a movie in theaters and 99% of people stick through it. Very few people actually walk out of a movie theater and don't come back. I almost never see it in theaters. I don't know about you guys, but like almost nobody walks out of a movie and goes and demands their money back and says, I don't want to, you know. But on the other hand, with these Netflix movies, where again, the vast majority of people are watching them, people aren't actually sitting and watching them like they watch movies. I think it is a strike against any film that is released on Netflix.
But that's a place where Netflix gets penalized for having data because, you know, Academy voters have no idea how many people complete, you know, watching something on a DVD.
Well, but they know how many people go see it in theaters.
Right, but it's because the weighting of where most of the viewing is going to happen is different. I mean, the incentives for theaters versus home viewing,
individual tickets. But if you're releasing this movie in a format that most people, that the vast majority of people aren't going to watch it properly.
Yeah.
Which is to say all at once.
Yeah.
I feel like that is a strike against the idea that, you know, you have to reward these things that are that are, you know, popular and populist, right? And which is a thing that the Academy has been trying to do more of, to say, like, we need to give the big movies more awards to get people to watch, you know, the show, blah, blah, blah. This has nothing to do with the quality of the film, obviously. In theory, you would like to have all the Academy members watching everything all the way through. But, like, I think it is an interesting thing to consider, especially, again, within the context of Netflix trying to essentially kill all of the studios.
Popularity has sometimes been part of what the Academy Awards, but not always. The Hurt Locker, when it won Best Picture in 2010, had something like a $15 million box office at the time that it won and was the lowest grossing Best Picture winner ever. Nobody saw that movie. I mean, not nobody, but like effectively
nobody saw that. But the people who did see it sat through it.
No, but this is the other thing. That you know as a critic and as a who gets year-end screeners, which is that Oscar voters, a lot of Oscar voters, just get screeners and watch most of the movies that they vote on that way.
This is largely true.
And there's two things about screeners. You're watching them at home, so you might watch them the way you watch movies on Netflix. And also, in many cases, they kind of look crappy. They look like old DVDs that don't, like, they're not
well, they're just
really
DVDs,
right.
Yeah.
But the quality of the images is not great for a lot of these Oscar screeners. And so the voters for actual Oscars are voting on movies that they have watched at home in a bad environment that hasn't, where the DVDs have not been properly prepared for watching at home. So you know what? The Netflix experience is superior to that.
Maybe. I don't know. Here is the question, then. Is Netflix's drip-drip method of data release a controversy or a non-controversy? Alyssa?
It's real annoying is what it is.
That's not an
answer. It's a controversy.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very much a controversy.
I will say it is a controversy because it is a controversy. They need to release those numbers. I demand it. The critics demand it. We need to know what the people are watching. Okay, in theaters now, where people will go to and they will sit through the whole movie and they'll watch the whole thing as you're supposed to do with a movie, is Rian Johnson's Whodunit, Knives Out, a twisty mystery with a progressive bent. Turns out that rich people are bad and lazy and illegal immigrants are noble and good or something like that. Anyway, don't get me wrong. Look, as a conservative, I feel fine saying that Knives Out is totally fine. It's amusing. The cast, which is led by Daniel Craig and Michael Shannon and Chris Evans and Jamie Lee Curtis and Don Johnson and Christopher Plummer, all fantastic. And Ana de Armas, I want to single her out. She remains one of, I think, the most interesting and electric actresses working today. But much like the Korean film Parasite, another movie about the awfulness of the wealthy and the iniquities of capitalism, I do think it has received a bit more praise than it deserves,
strictly speaking,
based solely on the politics of the thing. Now, Alyssa, as the resident bleeding heart liberal in this group, I have to wonder, how does it feel to be constantly pandered to by Hollywood all the time? Does it feel great? I assume it feels great.
It actually doesn't feel that great.
Oh.
This is one of those be careful what you wish for things. I was really annoyed by Knives Out.
Oh, really?
And I think it's sort of for two reasons. The first is that, you know, it's released as a Thanksgiving movie. It's this family drama, and it kind of is intended to play into, you know, the idea that everyone is fighting about politics with their family at Thanksgiving, which I actually think is not a thing that most families do. But, you know, I don't have, like Netflix, I don't have the numbers to back that up. So
this is just your supposition.
Yes. And yet it treats the conflicts within the family about politics in an incredibly shallow and glib way, right? Like, one of the kids in the family is ostensibly alt-right, but he's only alt-right so Daniel Craig can eventually say a line about a Nazi child masturbating in a bathroom. Like, literally, that's the only reason that the kids' politics exist in the movie. They don't drive the plot. They don't actually drive any of the family conflict. They're just there because it's like, oh, look what we're doing. We're talking about the radicalization of teenagers on YouTube, except not really, not at all.
Because Rian Johnson took an awful lot of heat from irritating alt-righter types on Twitter after The Last Jedi.
Exactly. And then you also have the sort of SJW college student who, again, whose politics don't matter at all, except in like a very minor subplot where she sort of betrays those politics and is immediately basically forgiven.
Yeah, is immediately sorry for it. Like, there's no consequences.
There's no exploration of that at all. And then the thing that has really bothered me is that Ana de Armas' character, Marta, the caregiver for the elderly mystery writer whose death kicks off the movie, she's supposed to be smart and spunky and more resilient than you would expect. And there's this whole subplot about her mom who is undocumented. But the movie treats her with the same amount of fundamental disinterest that the family that she works for does, right? Like, we know that her mother is undocumented, but we know literally nothing about her mother other than that. We know nothing about her other than that she's, like, spunky and capable and resilient. I mean, she has no personality other than that. And so the idea...
She has also no long-term goals or desires.
Yeah,
she is implicated potentially in the murder early on, and so but outside of the context of the murder itself, we never find out what she wants from her life.
Right, and the literal arc of her movie is that yes, indeed, she is who she thought she was and who the family thought she was. She's a good person and a good nurse, and the movie just feels really sort of self-congratulatory.
Oh,
and it's like, oh, this
so much so.
Yeah, yeah, it's like, oh, this immigrant has gotten one over on these, you know, rotten, privileged, spoiled, ridiculous people. But she is exactly as paper thin as they think she is. It's just, it has driven me completely bananas. And I mean, the movie is cute and clever and very aware of its own cuteness and cleverness, but it's in its own way, it's basically a Wes Anderson movie.
I would say it's much less like, well done than a Wes Anderson
exactly.
movie.
Yeah, but it's like it's a Wes Anderson movie without the like actual commitment to the idea and aesthetics and difficult emotions.
Right.
It drove me nuts.
Peter, what did you think?
Yeah, it's clever and reasonably well executed and also incredibly on the nose to the point of being fairly irritating. And what's even more so is that I think you could have made a version of this movie that was shorter, better, and less irritating, that was simply about the clever plot gimmicks and didn't emphasize all of the kind of social message stuff that the movie just trips over. It's so obvious and so uncomplicated and so smugly satisfied with itself that there's... You kind of find yourself like wondering, wait, is there going to be a twist to this? Is there going to be some extra layer or level? And no, the movie's ideas and messages are exactly what you think they're going to be about 2 minutes into the movie, and then it doesn't actually twist anything. It doesn't offer anything more than that.
The only thing that's really enjoyable about the movie is Chris Evans essentially returning to playing the obnoxious character that he played in the adaptation of Scott Pilgrim, and actually playing with his sort of like good guy, outside of the movie, woke, progressive Captain America image, and having him just return to playing a sleaze, which is something that he's actually incredibly good at, is highly enjoyable.
Yeah.
But it's also entirely not political, right? It's just like he is just the... There's not a message to his obnoxious wastrelness.
Yeah.
He's just like a spoiled rich boy, but not in a way that's used to make a point. And it's probably the most enjoyable thing in the movie.
The movie is 2 hours and 10 minutes long. And I think there's an hour and 50-minute cut of the movie,
oh,
perhaps with a
there's
little
a
bit.
There's a 100-minute cut.
Perhaps even.
There's a 90-minute cut of the movie.
But perhaps even, I mean, it might require a little bit of refilming, but not a whole lot that makes Daniel Craig's detective more central rather than a kind of co-lead where he is occasionally the lead and then in the very end he steps in to become sort of fully the lead character, even though the movie has kind of generously doled out the feeling of leadness without actually quite getting to the lead to Ana de Armas' character.
It's an ostensibly progressive, diverse movie that entirely wastes Lakeith Stanfield, who is a tremendously enjoyable actor, and they slot him in as the sort of boring straight man cop for no discernible reason.
Well, and what's impressive is that he does a great job with this little role, right? He's very he stands out in that role. It's just not very well written. It's I think not a great use of his talents.
It's kind of a nothing role.
I also found the movie somewhat underwhelming visually. So it's nicely, the camera movements, it's nicely framed, but the color palette just really seems drained of life.
It feels a little bit drab.
It feels very Thanksgiving, right? It's, you know,
but it
the leaves
also
have
didn't,
fallen.
It also didn't feel rich, you know, with color in the way that fall can be. It felt sort of flat and digital in a way that I just couldn't quite describe. Maybe it was just the place I saw it at. I did see a digital projection of it, but in the way that that kind of mid-budget digital digital projection and digital filming often feels flat. Mm-hmm. I just felt like this the movie kind of didn't have the life that it should have and didn't have the sort of the depth and richness of detail.
Can I just
it made it feel a little bit cheaper. Like it's a $40 million movie. It did not feel like a $40 million film.
Can I just ask, because I am kind of fascinated by the critical response to this movie, and then comparing it also to some of the early critical responses to Richard Jewell, which we'll get to next week. And, you know, I keep seeing reviews that are kind of like, you know, Richard, I think the Daily Beast headline on their review was Richard Jewell is kind of entertaining before it devolves into a MAGA, blah, 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 blah. And, you know, the obvious difference between that and the response to this, which is like the pointed political satire, whodunit, Knives Out. I don't like to harp on about critics being liberal, though 98% of critics are, in fact, liberal, because I feel like they usually do a pretty good job of separating that from the artistry of movies. And this is one that just, like, I think totally failed. And I don't know if it's a function of Rian Johnson being so active on Twitter. I don't know if it's a function of people wanting him to get a win after the Last Jedi bloodbath, you know, internet fight arguments, angst, all that. Or if it is just as simple as, like, this movie posits that immigrants are good and that rich people are bad, and this like nicely confirms all of our previously held beliefs. I don't know.
I think it's probably a mix of things. I think people were surprised that it was political. That was not really something that was evident from the trailers necessarily. And so I think people were like, oh, he's sneaking politics into this movie, or not even sneaking them, but like, he's made this very diverting movie.
He's hammering politics into this movie.
He's sneaking politics into this movie the way, like, somebody dumping an entire bottle of Hershey's onto a scoop of ice cream is sneaking Hershey's chocolate sauce onto the ice cream.
But it wasn't – I mean, the movie was not advertised as a political movie. And so I think there was a certain amount of surprise in screenings. I also think that – and this is something we've talked about not on the podcast – that – a lot of critics have been very politicized by the Trump era. And the Trump era has coincided with a conversation about diversity in mass culture and the political role of art. Where I don't think this conversation has quite coalesced is I don't know that you see critics en masse like trooping off to like read Rules for Radicals and critical race theory stuff and developing a political analysis that goes along with their sense that art should be doing more political work. And so I don't think that the left-leaning, you know, critical commentariat has kind of developed an agenda and a set of standards, right? I don't think there is a well-established sense of what the goals of the diversity movement for Hollywood ought to be, other than that there should be more of it. I don't know that people have a sense of what a sort of meaningful political movie is, or even about the relationship of art to existing political platforms, right? Like, is good political art that expresses the Democratic Party's position on impeachment / gender identity / immigration, or is good political art that operates outside of the bounds of sort of existing political discourse and tries to expand them? These are just not a set of conversations that have happened broadly among the politically engaged circle of critics. And I think that these kinds of movies might generate a more robust and interesting discussion if some of those first principles caught up to just sort of a larger politicization among that critical community.
Yeah. I'm not – well, I am not 100% sure. It's – You're talking about, you know, theory, I think, here more than you know.
Sure, but I think that
the actual attitudes that are held.
But I think there's a sort of mismatch between sort of passion and program, right? I mean, I think if we look at our critic friends on Twitter, you know, a lot of them talk a lot more about politics than they did prior to 2016. Again, I can't quantify that. Maybe I need my Netflix style, whatever.
Anecdotally, I would certainly agree with you.
Yes.
And, you know, I am somewhat unusual in that I come to criticism both from, like, I was an elected Democratic Party official in New Haven. I have gotten involved in, you know, I've gotten arrested for civil disobedience. I came out of a political and policy reporting background. And I think that makes me just somewhat different from a lot of other critics. And as someone who was beating a lot of these drums early, I am excited that this conversation has moved into the critical mainstream. But I think that there is a set of first principles issues that has yet to be proposed, much less debated, and that makes conversations around movies like this sort of befuddling.
So to me, it's partially a formal issue, which is that you have people who a lot of our best critics, one of the reasons that they're our best critics is that's what they've done their whole lives. Basically, they came out of college and they got jobs writing about art or, you know, in culture, and that's what they've done. And so that's the kind of writing and the kind of arguing that they are used to doing. But in the Trump era, a lot of them have, as Alyssa says, ended up writing and arguing a lot about politics. And these are, even though they're both journalism and they're both criticism and they're both argument, they're different forms. And if you've ever edited a novelist trying to write an op-ed, novelists who are great novelists and really exceptionally good writers are often not great op-ed writers, at least if they don't do it on a very regular basis. And there's just a kind of formal distinction. And one of the things that connects the three of us, and I think one of the reasons the three of us get along, is that we've always kind of straddled this weird divide where we've had a foot in the world of political journalism and had, you know, a bunch. We have all done a bunch of either editing or writing as in the world of political journalism, and then also done a bunch of writing and editing in the worlds of arts and culture criticism. And they're two, not completely unrelated, but two distinct and different forms. And you have all of these people who are now doing effectively political writing for the first time. And it's not surprising that they don't do it all that well in many cases.
So you're saying we're annoyed by the shallowness of it all?
I'm saying that there are formal properties that take time to learn
and there are different bodies of knowledge, right? I mean, there are film critics who have, you know, vastly more deft technical senses than I do of how this stuff works, but have never covered a House Oversight Committee hearing.
Right.
And you learn something different by covering the House Oversight Committee for 3 years.
Which is a different kind of theater.
Oh, my Lord. Let me tell you about it. It was a lot.
Yeah.
But, yeah, these are just
It's different.
Different things.
It's just different. All right. So what do you guys think? Thumbs up or thumbs down?
Thumbs down.
Thumbs sideways. But if I have to pick up or down, I'm going to go down, honestly. I didn't hate the movie. I thought it, like I did think it was clever and reasonably effective just on the mystery level. But overall, I didn't think it fully worked.
I'm going to go thumbs up. I'm going to buck the trend here. Thumbs up, just because it kept my attention for 2 hours and 10 minutes, which is not an easy thing to do.
Wow, Sonny's the one who praises
here.
The liberal message movie.
Like, you know, it
Art, and now, it's politically unpredictable.
Now I feel like I got to get out there and start protesting. Where's my pink hat? All right. Finally, we move to assigned viewing. Up this week is the first movie in what I like to think of as Clint Eastwood's American hero cycle, American Sniper. Alyssa, why are we watching American Sniper this week?
We are watching American Sniper, which is Eastwood's 2014 movie about sniper Chris Kyle, played here by Bradley Cooper, because we are coming up on Richard Jewell, his movie about the security guard who foiled a bombing, then was sort of falsely blamed for it, and the media sensation that resulted. And it's a really interesting movie, both sort of formally and in its central performance by Cooper, who I think has probably never been better than he is in this. Because it's a war movie and it's a very effective action movie in a lot of stretches, but it's also a highly interior movie about what it means to be a man, and one that works in sort of more interesting and sophisticated ways than you might necessarily expect, given, Eastwood's surface reputation. I love it. It's not necessarily a movie that I think seems like the kind of thing that would be my jam, but I've watched it 3, 4, maybe even 5 times at this point, and I'm just sort of constantly struck by how many interesting things are happening in it, and just what wonderful work Cooper does as Kyle.
Yeah.
It's a much better movie than I remembered it being. I honestly didn't love it when I saw it in the theater, and I had not seen it again until this week. But the first two-thirds of it in particular are really kind of... I mean, the Bradley Cooper's work is excellent and understated. The kind of this is perhaps the best use of Clint Eastwood's terse, understated, kind of color range, you know, no frills directorial style, and also his ability to get these very naturalistic performers out of his actors. What I didn't like when I first saw the movie, and what I continue not to like, is the entire enemy sniper subplot,
which
just comes across as contrived and like, oh, you know, there's like this screenplay rule that the protagonist should always face an antagonist who is his double, who is his negative, right? Mm-hmm. He's the same except the opposite, and
it literalizes that,
right? Here. And it's just a sort of a very kind of dry recit, you know, going through the motions of doing that screenplay thing, and it's not true. And what I found out when I was looking, when I was reading about this movie, while I was looking this up to before we had this conversation, was that the enemy sniper stuff all came from Steven Spielberg, who was originally going to direct this movie and then gave it up when he couldn't, when the studio wouldn't provide a big enough budget for him to make it the way he wanted to do it. But that was all incorporated into the screenplay. And it's so Spielbergian when you think about it, right? It's like, oh, he must take on his double, and it's the enemy sniper who is him, but bad, but evil.
But I do think part of what's interesting about the way the movie handles that plot is that even when he kills him, it's totally unsatisfying, right?
Yes.
They're plunged immediately into this really traumatic battle. He comes home. He's a mess. It's not a triumph, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the fact that it's not true, I think, is sort of a problem in a movie that really aims for this kind of verisimilitude. But it is very undercut in the actual emotional dynamics of the movie. He's, you know, the sniper who they nicknamed Mustafa exists in fiction in the movie, but he also kind of exists mostly in Chris Kyle's head. You know, he is a fiction that Kyle has kind of woven for himself out of these theoretical details, like, oh, he was a Syrian Olympic sniper. You know, they don't actually really know anything about him.
They show in the movie an image of him getting like an Olympic medal or something like that. So they do suggest
I think it's like a picture on the wall.
Right. There is textual evidence that that is true.
Yeah, yeah.
But the actual sort of antagonism and the sense of him is sort of a creation in Kyle's head. And then when that goes away, the trauma of the war doesn't disappear, right? I mean, if the whole movie is set up as this duel, but once the duel is over and Kyle wins, he still loses.
Yeah. I would say, so I will say that as, like Peter, I did not love it the first time around, and I kind of underappreciated one of the things it does very, very well. And I say this as the child of, as a military kid, that it captures the rhythm of military life very, very well.
Yeah.
The kind of the deployments and the returns and the deployments and the returns and all of that stuff, the kind of anxiousness that comes with having a loved one on the battlefield and all that stuff. I mean, there's a very real quality to all of that that I can't remember any other film capturing, and that a movie like The Hurt Locker, which we mentioned earlier in the show, kind of totally whiffs on this because we don't see any of it. We just see, I remember in The Hurt Locker, that movie kind of ends with with the main character going home and like being bored in a shopping mall or being bored in a grocery store and then going back out there because he needs the rush of battle.
Yeah. Well, it's a very Catherine Bigelow-esque yeah. approach to masculinity, which right. is that men are basically just yeah. you know kind of testosterone maniacs,
action junkies, and I think that what American Sniper gets at is the sense of duty. The sense of duty that these guys kind of live with, and how it can, how the competing duties to your men and to the people you're trying to protect and to your family can all kind of collide, and you know what wins out at the end.
But it also looks in some very interesting ways about at the extent to which that's sort of a rationalization. I mean, there's a scene towards the end of the movie when Chris is talking to his wife Taya. And she's asking, you know, why do you have to do it? Why do you have to go back? And he's like, well, I'm protecting you. And she says, you're just lying to me about that. Like, that's yeah. just not true. And it's a movie that is able to hold competing ideas sort of in balance. I say in balance rather than in tension, because I think it's both true. Like, we have seen how much obligation Kyle feels to his men. You have these flashbacks to his relationship with his father about sort of what the line between being sort of a protector and a predator is. But it's also true that he is having trouble sort of connecting with her and some aspects of civilian life. I mean, there's this scene where he's home, his daughter's just been born. It's not clear whether he was there for the birth, but he's sort of blowing up at the nurses in the nursery because they're not immediately attending to his daughter. And the movie just allows Cooper's character to have a lot of complexity without forcing him to sort of psychoanalyze it or unpack all of it. And it's nicely balanced in a way that's very interesting.
It's a movie that I think got a mistaken reputation for being a knee-jerk, very simple right-wing film. And I would say that if you had to classify its politics, it's on the right. Like, I don't think that's yeah. wrong. But it's actually a quite complex right-of-center film. And it's certainly not one that glorifies war or makes war seem simple yeah. in a way yeah. that... in some ways, it is... It's much more of a model for how to do a politically inflected film than Knives Out. And the yes. two are really worth contrasting and comparing, because Knives Out is so simple and so satisfied with the conclusion that it draws from minute one, whereas American Sniper, while certainly working from a political worldview that is distinct and identifiable, is a movie that doesn't always seem sure of itself, and that makes it a better movie.
Thank you very much for that. Assigned viewing for next week is The Last Jedi. Our winter of Rian Johnson continues as we prepare for the culmination of the Skywalker saga in movie theaters. All right, that's it for Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Rebeller. Please go to rebellermedia.com and sign up for a membership. If you don't sign up, we don't get to keep doing this. If you loved it, please tell your friends. And review us at Apple and every other site. We need those reviews, people. And if you didn't love it, complain to me on Twitter at SunnyBunch. I will convince you that this is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed each and every week. See you guys next week.
Across the Movie Aisle is a Rebeller Podcast Network original, hosted by Sunny Bunch, Alyssa Rosenberg, and Peter Suderman. Produced by Sunny Bunch and Natasha Passetta. Executive producer, Dallas Sanye. Associate producer, Jessica Safa-Vamer. Art and design by Jason Koslerich. Sound recording, design, and mixing by Sunny Bunch, with music by James Malone.